everybody, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. This very special podcast conversation with a few folks that I think you're going to find very, very exciting and intriguing in where they're coming from in the business space, particularly in the Black and minority-owned entrepreneurial space, which is so, so exciting right now, given a number of the changes that are out there, but also some signs we need to be concerned about and issues that we need to address. Joining me for this conversation is my buddy, former Congressman Ed Towns, who was the congressman from the 10th Congressional District in Brooklyn, where he served for 15 terms. He's an ordained minister and professional social worker. He founded and chaired the Congressional Social Work Caucus and was actively engaged in several congressional caucuses during his service in Congress and when he chaired the Congressional Black Caucus. My buddy Ed, welcome. Man, it's great
always,
to have you back.
Always a pleasure. Always a pleasure. You know that.
And the congressman was instrumental in bringing someone to the table whom I've had the pleasure to watch literally for the past year or so as she has emerged in an incredible way in the United States Congress, Congresswoman Plaskett, who is just doing phenomenal work right now in Congress. She is the first member of a territory to be nominated to the Exclusive Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives. She is no doubt a rising star, an expert on financial matters. Congresswoman Plaskett is also a member of the House Committee on Budget. Having received her undergraduate degree from the Georgetown University School of Foreign Services, Hoya Saxon as a law grad, appreciate that. And her Juris Doctorate from American University's Washington College, where my niece and nephew went. So we got that connection going too. She started as an assistant district attorney in the Bronx DA's office and as well worked as a political appointee at the Department of Justice, where she served as senior counsel under both Deputy Attorney General Larry Thompson and his successor, James Comey. Congresswoman, it's a great treat to have you as part of our conversation.
I'm honored to be with you, gentlemen. It's great to be here with you guys.
Excellent, excellent. And joining us also at the table is Lisa Song Sutton. She's an entrepreneur, real estate investor, and former Miss Nevada. She specializes in business litigation, which she did when she worked at a leading law firm in Las Vegas. As a diversified entrepreneur, Lisa has scaled multiple 7- and 8-figure companies, published numerous articles for Forbes Inc. magazine, and Business Insider on business and entrepreneurship. And this is interesting. I love this work that you're doing here, Lisa, specifically as an advocate for the veteran community. She's currently a general partner with a $10 million pre-seed venture capital fund called the Veteran Fund, which invests in veteran-led and military spouse-led companies. Wow, that's so great. And so glad to have you join us in the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be here with you all.
Well, let's just set the stage for the conversation and what really kind of animated Ed and myself to come together in an op-ed that we did back a few months ago addressing proposed elimination of the stepped-up basis protection in the STEP Act and the impact it would have on small businesses. And the reality of it is, folks, as both of you know, both as practical application and legislative application, you know, minorities are operating more than 8 million businesses across the country, generating $1.4 trillion in revenue and employ 7 million people. That's what we do as minority-owned firms in the country. Our total U.S. unemployment rate fell to 5.4% in July of this year, but it remains a staggering 8.2% for Black workers. Across the 50 states, there are 2.6 million Black-owned businesses that generate more than $138 billion in revenue annually. And the gaps in both Participation rates and account balances were found between Black and white workers at every income level, even in instances where African Americans made the same salary as white workers. So while the field is fertile, there are thorns and there are problems that remain to be addressed. And so, Congresswoman, starting with you on this question of what are some of the legislative remedies that can be brought to bear that maybe you are currently working on or advocating for, which can have immediate and impactful resonance in minority communities?
Well, thanks so much for the question. You know, I think we need to go back to the fact that government has a real responsibility in this, because the gaps that we have predominantly in Black communities as well as communities of color were in many ways created by government, right? Whether through slavery as a systemic oppression through Jim Crow laws and institutionalized racism, or disparities in access to and outcomes in education, healthcare, jobs, and even housing. You just heard this wonderful veterans run VC that's being started by Ms. Song Sutton, but the GI Bill in after World War II systemically kept Black veterans away from being able to access. So the government has a tremendous role to play. And I think right now what we're trying to do is utilizing the tremendous pieces of legislation that have passed in the last year and a half in Congress and make sure that those transformative funding is going to be available to Black businesses and Black families. Whether it's the American Rescue Plan, which turned the tide on the pandemic and child poverty, making sure that the job creation that is coming in fact is happening in Black homes as well. And for the bipartisan infrastructure bill, which has the ability not only to create long-term jobs and job skills, but even contracting and access to the funding that's there to make sure that those are going to communities of color, communities that have been left behind, and specifically to Black businesses as well.
And I'm gonna turn it over to you. Ed's a guest, but Ed's also my partner in this. And yeah, so no, Ed, go for it.
No, actually, you know, I hear you, and I think that you really, you know, pointed out things that needs to be done. But, you know, there's always a problem in terms of working together when it comes to getting legislation done in the United States House of Representatives. What do you suggest? What can we do to be able to pull the parties together to be able to talk about the whole issue of wealth? Because a lot can be done if we could just sort of begin to have the discussion to make it happen. How do we pull people together to do that?
You know, I think, and Congressman Towns, you know better than I, that I think that sometimes the best discussions are those that are done behind closed doors and not necessarily in hearing rooms. And if we create roundtables and discussions like you're having, I'll give you an example. In the Virgin Islands, after we had our hurricanes, Puerto Rico and the Virgin Islands were able to get the law changed in a tremendously bipartisan manner to pump tremendous amount of funding into the territories and change the Stafford Act to change the law to rebuilding as it was at the time of the storm, to rebuilding as it should be. And we made the argument in a bipartisan way that, listen, this is gonna cost us so much more in the long term if we only give the Virgin Islands or Puerto Rico the money to rebuild as it was then, rather than putting in the resources on the front end to make them more resilient for the hurricanes that are gonna come, and also recognizing that we missed the ball in terms of funding for them so that those they could harden their systems and their public infrastructure beforehand. And I think that same argument can be made to members across on both sides of the spectrum that listen, this is what it is costing America, this wealth gap. We lose $151 billion a year in productivity through child poverty, where children who are either dropping out of school, children who end up in incarceration, children who are hungry, that's what it's costing our country. And I think having those conversations behind closed doors quietly among one another is the way that we've been able to move the ball forward, whether it was the bipartisan infrastructure bill or the ones that we are going to have to. And we each have to give up something. Both sides have to give up something and meet somewhere in the middle. What do you think? Did that work during your day? I know we're in a completely different time and right now, but I'm hoping that that could still work.
I hope so too. You know, what happened during my time is that we formed a basketball team, you know, and that the basketball team was able to establish a kind of working coalition there that was able to sort of influence in terms of both parties. And the basketball team was both Democrats and Republicans. And we would go across the nation doing fundraising for various organizations that helped us to be able to talk to each other. Because right now, you know, when you sort of look at it from an outside view, I mean, you know, you say, well, my God, you know, there's no discussion between each other, and that needs to happen in order to get quality kind of legislation. But I'm excited about your involvement, because anytime you come from an island, a territory, and to be able to serve on the Ways and Means Committee and to be able, and never been done before, I mean, I think that leadership is the kind of leadership that they really need in the Congress. And I'm excited about you being there and what you're doing. So if they say in the Baptist church, I'm praying for you.
we all are.
You need to do some fasting and praying for me. That's what I need.
Well, you know, and you know, the Congressman Towns raises a very important point about recognizing leadership and allowing that leadership to emerge, particularly around issues like this, where you bring Congressman Plaskett a fresh perspective, obviously, some very unique experience and skill sets that can help shape that. One of the things that I really pushed a lot when I was Lieutenant Governor of Maryland was this idea of bringing that fresh leadership to bear on making hard choices. Mm-hmm. Because sometimes, with all due respect to the old boys in the room, don't want to necessarily move. And so, because it's comfortable, you know, it's, you know, it's a lot like this backdrop. It's a nice, comfortable space, you know, you just sort of sit back, kick back and chill, and you don't necessarily want to move the needle, but you need to move the needle when it comes to making the difference on things that impact generational wealth, which is where we are right now, coming on the other side of COVID. How do you see the best ways to grow generational wealth, what I called legacy wealth when I was Lieutenant Governor, this idea that if the Rockefellers and the Kennedys and all those fancy names on buildings in New York could do it, why can't, you know, the Browns and the Johnsons and so forth do it today? And I think that that's an important piece for us to really begin to get our hands around, because I think it'll impact what America looks like going forward into the future.
Yeah, you know, I think that there are several things that we can work on here in Congress. Many of us believe that there are several areas where wealth is created, whether that's in education or housing, jobs, and healthcare. And I think that you'll find that members of Congress are working in each of those. Policies that reduce the cost of college attendance and student loans could also increase opportunities for wealth accumulation for Black households. Likewise, policymakers should work on correcting existing homeownership policies that have disproportionately benefited white households and have implicitly and explicitly, in some instances, restricted Black home ownership and create new policies to support that home buyers. You know, automatic IRAs and savers credit refundable, providing workers without employer-sponsored retirement benefits access to tax advantage retirement savings. You know, little things like that, that we think in the aggregate working together are ways that we can work to ensure and drive wealth creation. You know, I think education, home ownership, those are the ones that we've historically found are the greatest means to access for generational wealth creation. I mean, we know, and you've cited these statistics before, medium wealth for white families is $171,000. The median wealth for the same size Black family is $17,000.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to do something to create equity across the board. And I think that you're going to find that members of Congress are working in a lot of ways, particularly with this administration, whether it's with HUD, Pell Grants, et cetera, to try and level the playing field.
Lisa, let's get your perspective, because I think this is a very nice little moment where you as an entrepreneur, someone who is out there creating jobs, creating wealth, working with companies that are doing that, how do you see efforts to try to pull together the moment, if you will, for Black and brown communities across the country? What's been your experience, and what solutions do you think maybe the congresswoman is could be aware of or made more aware of?
I think certainly in the entrepreneurship community and the minority entrepreneurship community, some of our biggest hurdles are regulation and taxes, right? If you want to go out and start a business, you go file your LLC, but then the next steps are required. And depending on what industry or what business you want to start, there's loads of regulations and red tape to kind of sift through. And if you're a first-time entrepreneur, if you're, kind of starting your way and making your way, your parents worked hard to provide for you, to hopefully give you that American dream, right? And get you through college, get you through grad school. A lot of entrepreneurs that I meet that come from the minority community, they didn't have parents who were also entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. So they didn't have someone to lead them through the business hurdles and the regulatory red tape. They didn't have someone to kind of set that path for them. And so they've had to navigate it all on their own. And it's onerous, right? It's really, really tough, especially if you do have onerous regulations and burdensome regulations. It just makes it that much harder for people to navigate.
Ed, what were your thoughts, Ed?
Yeah, on that note, so really the first year cost is what keeps a lot of folks from being able to go into business. Is that the problem?
I think that the cost, as well as just the lack of education around it. Again, if you didn't come from a family where your mom or dad was an entrepreneur or a business owner, I think sometimes it's really difficult to break into that without leadership and mentorship, which is why it's so important for us to create communities around that, especially with our minority entrepreneurs, to show them that there's a pathway for it and this is how they can do it.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And Congresswoman, it kind of dovetails into, particular facets of this conversation, which oftentimes get overlooked, like the digital divide, healthcare, other aspects that come into play that I'm sure Lisa knows all too well, trying to build business, have a dollar sign attached to them, but are also behind that is a hell of a lot of regulation.
Yeah.
In some cases, or in other cases, very little regulation by Congress, where in the case of the digital divide, everybody has a talk about, oh, we've got to provide access and opportunities, but there hasn't been a lot there legislatively. And to the extent that there has, the regulations really haven't stayed current with what's going on in the field. How do you look at addressing some of that in your leadership on Ways and Means and the Budget Committee, et cetera?
Sure. Well, first, with regard to the digital divide, I think that, speaking specifically about that one first, that's an area that you're going to see across the board members have been tackling from both rural as well as urban areas. The pandemic has really demonstrated how deep this divide is in this country. Even after $100 billion of investment that has been made by the federal government in this space, that more needs to be done. And I think that, what we saw in terms of education, of small business entrepreneurship during the COVID pandemic, really demonstrated that has to happen. And you're hearing members like Abigail Spanberger, who represents mm-hmm. a really rural area of Virginia, partnering with Jim Clyburn out of South Carolina, and Frank Pallone, who's chair of energy and commerce out of, you know, the suburbs of New Jersey, all recognize that this is a tremendous issue and really a problematic for us. But, you know, Lisa, one of the things I wanted to share with you that we have been doing both in the regulatory space as well as an innovation for small businesses, particularly minority-owned businesses, is that on the Ways and Means Committee, Chairman Neal has put together a group of members consisting of Stephen Horsford out of Nevada, your state, along with Jimmy Gomez out in California, Terry Sewell, to look at how does the tax laws, how do we use tax law to create equity? How do we use tax law to really ensure that communities that have not had the benefit of being able to get tax to support them do so, whether it's through tax credits, whether it's really directing the new form of Build America bonds or new market tax credits to areas that need it most. And then one of the more exciting things that I've been working on is I teamed up with two younger members, Marilyn Strickland, who's a new member out of Washington State, Tacoma, Washington, and Richie Torres, who comes from your neck of the woods, Ed Townsend, the Bronx, really dynamic young member of Congress, who's on the Financial Service Committee. Marilyn Strickland, of course, has her experience having been out in Washington, really seeing technology in there. We have just launched a new caucus called the Congressional Caucus on Black Innovation, because we recognize that for Black entrepreneurs, Black investors, people of color, that there has not been enough support given by us as legislators in that area. So what we want to do is engage the private sector investors, industry leaders, and academics to discuss solutions and leverage congressional resources to provide the support necessary to advance wealth creation in the technology age. We recognize that, you know, while there has been tremendous amount of funding in terms of whether it's venture capital, private equity, that only 1% of that is going to Black founders. And the impact of that is tremendous across the board. And, you know, that one study showed that, you know, doing and examining Black businesses in greater Cincinnati revealed that Black businesses had an annual impact of $1.4 billion annually and employed over 8,000 people with an annual earnings of $540 million. Yet, 30% of the revenue of Black businesses are used to resolve debt that they have, that they're not able to get that second round funding or additional support to help them to grow. And the debt is, as you said, Congressman Towns, from that first year, from the upstart of their businesses. So we're gonna try and resolve some of these issues and try and use the leverage of the congressional bully pulpit to try and force investors and banks to truly put their money where their mouth is, particularly after Black Lives Matter, when they all said how they're going to be supporting.
Yeah, exactly.
Actually gets on the ground, right? How many times did we hear, you know, for the next 10 years, we're going to spend $10 billion in Black entrepreneurship. And then, you know, 2 years later, it's been crickets as to where that money has gone. As well as, and Lisa, I think this is the area where Republican and Democrats can work together, is streamlining regulations. Mm-hmm. That's something that myself as a moderate Democrat and my, you know, neighbors across the hall who are moderate Republicans can find common place to work together to make sure that regulations support small businesses, in particular startup businesses, moving forward.
They may be a dying breed, but there are a few moderate Republicans left. We try to churn them up every once in a while.
They lurk in the corners of the floor. They don't want people to know that they're still there, but they're around.
So Lisa, what do you think of what you heard there?
I think it's fantastic, and I think it really takes, you know, fresh perspective and communication for one, you know, our elected officials to recognize that there is an issue, and then two, to really be innovative to try to do something about it. And I would also add as well, in addition to regulations, also just taxes and the tax structure. You know, especially with minority entrepreneurs, you work so, so hard to build what you have. And then part of it is that legacy piece, right? Like, you want to be able to build and grow something that hopefully you can pass down to your kids, and you can involve them in the business and teach them entrepreneurship from the ground up, and get them excited about, you know, being American business owners. And, you know, if we don't have the right tax structure, right? If we have onerous tax regulation and onerous taxes that don't allow for that wealth creation that you're talking about, that has the government kind of eating away at that, so mm-hmm. that you have less to be able to pass down as a legacy piece for your family, that's definitely something that I know a lot of entrepreneurs pay attention to and are concerned about as well.
I mean, listen, just even in this infrastructure bill right now that's out there, there is so much money out there, but do small businesses know how to tap into that?
Hmm.
Do they know how to go after these contracts? That's going to be the job of individuals like myself and other members of Congress, mayors, to really make sure that the people who need that funding and need that support are getting it. And I'm not sure if that's happening as yet, but we've got to raise the alarm bell before we lose that window of opportunity for them.
Right. Go ahead, Ann.
No, I was just saying, in terms of thinking about the tax structure, you know, when a person dies and passes on the business, you have to pay taxes on it right away, and I think that those are the kind of things that need to be corrected. And that's reason I'm excited about the caucus, you know, that you just described, Congresswoman, you know, because you have a thing, things that might be lawful, but they're awful. And maybe through your caucus, you might be able to help straighten some of that out.
Because
it's lawful, that does not mean it's awful.
Right.
You know, but it is, in many instances, is if it's, you know, if it's lawful, in many instances, it is awful.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, hope to keep straighten that out.
I thought one of the things Lisa said was so insightful, and it resonated with me from my own family, and I don't know about the others here, was that, you know, our parents sacrificed for us to get an education. But my parents thought that once you got into Georgetown, you know, it was all done. Like, you know, every door was going to open and all of this wealth was just going to rain down on you because you go to a great college or you graduate from that. And there are so many other layers that, you know, minority communities and my first generation college graduates from these families, we're just unaware of when we step out into the workspace.
Congresswoman, yep. you put your finger on a number of important points, as did Lisa and Ed. And before we let you move on to the business of Congress, and certainly that there's a lot of business right now that you're having to deal with, I wanted to posit a couple of thoughts and an idea with you. The thoughts are, and it really kind of goes to what Lisa and Ed raised. In fact, Ed and I wrote, like I said, an op-ed around this idea of what happens upon the transference of wealth, because that has a direct impact on that legacy piece that we're talking about. So as you're going about looking at and shaping new policy in this space, you know, consideration around reducing the tax on the capital gains, you know, on those assets that are gifted or transferred to people at the time of death. And that really kind of goes to the heart of the piece that Ed and I wrote around the STEP Act and the stepped up basis changes that were being considered. Keeping the Section 1031 like-kind exchange rules that allow for real estate investors to continue to receive tax deferment when they fix up their properties and make the kinds of improvements that they want to make, and then flip those properties in depressed and blighted neighborhoods. And the idea, we're right now looking at a capital, a top marginal rate, I guess, so somewhere around 37%. Recognizing that as some conversation is right now in Washington about increasing it to 39 to 40%, the impact that that's really going to have on the Lisa Suttons of the world and what they're doing as young entrepreneurs trying to create that legacy wealth. How do we create a Black middle class? How do we create an Asian middle class? How do we create, a stronger Hispanic middle class? Those communities that are directly impacted by our tax policies are often not part of the conversation. And I'll regale you offline with conversations I've had trying to work through both the 2008 economic crisis and the COVID crisis and trying to get resources to Black and brown communities, how difficult that is. So your leadership, I think, is going to be not just inspiring, but important in that regard. And I want to leave you with an idea, if you would be interested in starting a bipartisan caucus that will look at and focus on Black entrepreneurism, the impact on minority businesses writ large. And if you are interested, if I can find you a Republican, would you be interested in considering partnering up and working that caucus, growing that caucus opportunity in the House?
Sure. As a former Republican myself, having worked in the Bush administration, now coming over to the other side, I figure, I'm one of the few bilingual people in the House and willing to be the bridge when necessary.
Good. Well, I will be happy to follow up with your office and you directly on that piece, because it's something that I've given a lot of thought to. And I think, again, given your leadership and what you're doing, to have you be a part of something like that could be really, really important for a lot of communities around the country. And so I think we've got, before you go, I think we do have one question from a guest. And that is from Eugene. If Eugene is ready, then the congressman can scoot to her business if Eugene is ready to go.
Yes, thank you. Congresswoman, you mentioned something about the infrastructure funding. I have friends who have small businesses. And, whenever that topic comes up, they always tell me, well, it's always for the big companies, and if we become a part of it, we either come in as a sub and then if we do the work, they take a long time paying them and sure. So forth and so on.
Sure.
When you mentioned this pot of money, do you know if there's going to be any money set aside for just those minority companies? I mean, because apparently it's supposed to stimulate, their growth and sustain them. So,
Sure. I know there's been encouragement to do set asides at the local level in different states. As states, remember, so in the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act, there's set asides to each one of the states for specific projects that the state is doing. And states have been encouraged to do a portion of that for minority businesses. But then there are also larger streams of funding that the federal government is doing a competitive bidding for those projects also. And those projects also have set asides there, whether it's for 8A or other businesses within those competitive bidding. And of course, within the competitive bidding, those companies that are 8A and others do get preference in the bid cycle. So I would encourage someone, depending on where they live, where their business is located, to first, of course, contact their mayors and their state offices, because those states have specific funding as well, substantial funding for projects that they may qualify for. And when we think of infrastructure, people are always thinking of contractors, construction, but those construction companies also need accountants. They need back office function, people who are gonna do payroll, HR functions as well to build that capacity, as well as all of the job training that's in there. So I first look at that, because I would think that the competitive bidding would be not as onerous at a local level as it would be at the federal level for those companies to first look at.
Okay.
All righty. Thank you so much, Eugene. I really appreciate it. Congresswoman Stacey Plaskett of the Virgin Islands, thank you so much taking time to join us and to share with us your thoughts on Black entrepreneurism, minority entrepreneurism, growth, legacy wealth, and the opportunities that you're working on to make lives better. So we really appreciate you.
Thank you so much. And I'm sorry we didn't have time that I could hear Ed Towns track and field story.
I think we leave with that the next time, Ed.
How about that? I'll never forget that.
I think that's what we do. We just lead with it.
Lead with the Ed Towns story.
Exactly. Exactly. Ed's my man. My man. I love it.
Well, thank you guys, Congresswoman. So much. And Lisa, love what you're doing. And anytime you need support, sister, just give my office a call and we'll be happy to help as well.
And much success to caucus. Much success.
Thank you.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's going to be a busy 8 months.
Yes, and I expect a call from you, Lieutenant Governor Steele, on who you're going to whisper a name to me of.
There you go.
Okay,
great. No, promised. It's coming.
Thank you. Thanks so much. You guys take care.
Take care. Lisa, so while we have you, let's drill down a little bit on some of the things that you're doing right now in the entrepreneurial space, and you laid out for the Congresswoman some of the ideas and changes that would be recommended. How have you seen, particularly coming off of COVID, the recovery for the businesses that you're working with, and overall the general feel out there on the street with inflation now hitting businesses and families, gas prices, all of these things? What impact are you seeing in terms of how entrepreneurs out there are responding?
I mean, you guys know, private sector, we have to innovate, right? And the ones of us that survived the pandemic and all the, you know, shutdowns and the government picking who's open, who's essential, who's not essential. When you're a small business owner, your business is essential. So regardless of your product or service, or whether the state government thinks that your business is essential to you as a business owner, that's your livelihood, that's your legacy, that's your wealth creation, it is essential. So navigating that, coming out of that, and now being faced with inflation, higher pricing for your cost of goods, higher pricing for transport of those goods to get to your store so that you can sell that to your customer. It's been a tough time, right? With the entrepreneurs that I work with, people are concerned. You know, they know that they came out of a tough time and we're still in a tough time.
Right.
But the beautiful thing about private sector is that we adapt, right? We adapt, we innovate. We certainly don't wait around for the government to take care of us. No. We just push and we make it happen. So it's resiliency at its finest.
Ed, what are frustrations, buddy? I mean, you know, when you look at it, you were inside the bubble for a long time and understand some of the dynamics that are involved in getting legislation passed. But then when you hear entrepreneurs, especially like Lisa, who are out there on the front lines, as I like to say, she's creating jobs. Government doesn't do that.
Right.
So she's on that front line. Why is it seemingly so hard for our Congress to level that playing field a lot more it really tacks to what Eugene asked the Congresswoman in his question. You know, you say there's money, but will we see it? You know, Lisa's point, you know, yeah, it's great that you created this program, but it's so heavily regulated, I can either access it or stay in it. So why is that so problematic, do you think?
Well, not only that, sometimes it takes so long to get it. I mean, you know, and that also can be a problem, because, you know, you just can't wait forever to be able to get those resources. Because you have to pay people, all kinds of things, your bills have to be paid, all these kind of things must go on, and you're still waiting for them to make a decision, you know, on your, and many times, by the time they make a decision, you're out of business, you know, and you know, so the decision really doesn't affect you, it doesn't apply to you anymore, because you're no longer in that business. So the whole thing is that to be able to get resources out a lot faster to people that who really, really need it. And I think that that's the key, that has to be another way in terms of doing this and making it happen a lot quicker, because, you know, people are sitting there waiting and waiting and waiting. And by the time they get it, the rent is overdue. And of course, they can't be able to go back into the business because they've been out of it. You know, and it's just that kind of thing. So, which has to be a timetable. If a person makes an application, there should be a timetable on when those resources will get to that particular person, because having that uncertainty runs a lot of people out of business, you know, and a lot of folks, you know, can't make it because of, and I've known situations where people go out of business and then they say, here, your check, you know, you have a check right now. But right. That check does him no good, you know, because he's no longer in the business anymore. So that's the kind of thing in terms of the red tape has to be cut. The time on it has to be cut in terms of when you get resources out to people. And that has to be something that has to be discussed and worked out, so folks that are in business will be able to stay in the business. And plus, you're not certain as to whether you're going to get the resources. All right. These things makes it almost impossible for you to have a normal kind of operation during that kind of process. Yeah, and that's what's happening, I think, now quite a bit, because people that were in business are now trying to get back into business. And that's, again, becomes a real problem in terms of trying to start back over.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially if they're trying to leverage some of the resources that they received from the government during the COVID crisis. And I do know a number of entrepreneurs who are dealing with issues related to that have impacted their operations. And so, Lisa, that kind of falls into the bucket of, you're in the business of scaling up businesses. That's what you do.
Yeah.
How do you find this environment now on the back end, trying to, is it a rescaling operation? Is it starting fresh? What do you see happening, and what are you doing to help these businesses try to recover after COVID, to either get back to where they left off, or at least move the ball a little bit further down in the field for them?
Sometimes you just have to completely adapt and innovate. So as a prime example, one of my businesses is a bakery, and this is our 10th year of business. So we were established going into the pandemic in 2020, but March of 2020, our governor here in Nevada shut down the strip, closed the Las Vegas strip for over 90 days. And what that did was it completely decimated our tourist market. And as a result, a lot of the ancillary businesses that service those casinos and the strip and all those tourists, like my bakery, we saw, you know, all of our business cancel or postpone for the rest of the year in a 2-week time period in March of 2020. Mm-hmm. And then we were told that we were not essential, that the bakery itself couldn't open. And luckily, as a diversified entrepreneur, I had other businesses that were deemed essential, like, for example, my shipping business. I have a few shipping stores around town, kind of like a UPS store, but we're independent. So we service UPS, FedEx, and the Postal Service. So those were open. Those were allowed to be open. So what we did was we adapted and innovated. I bought mini fridges and put mini fridges in my ship stores that were allowed to be open. And then what we did, because we kept all of our staff at the bakery still, even though we had no more customers anymore, we started baking cupcakes that I brought over to the ship stores, put them in the mini fridges, and then we turned on DoorDash and Grubhub.
Wow.
As third-party delivery services, right? And we made my ship stores pick up locations for the cupcakes so that we could still keep the operations
going.
And
that's an entrepreneur for you, folks. That's an entrepreneur.
Seriously, though, right? It's like it's the government literally picking the winners and losers, telling you your business is not essential. Cupcakes are not essential. So you will be fined if you open the retail portion of it to the public. You are not allowed to be open. I mean, we just, yeah. The government has to get out of the way, yeah. You know, they've got to get out of the way and let us figure out what we need to do. Our priority is our customers, right? Of course, we want to keep people safe. We want to keep people healthy. So we're going to take every precaution that we need to, certainly in 2020, as well as we're navigating the whole thing. But that's what we did. You know,
I mean, doesn't the government realize we need our cupcakes during a shutdown?
Hello?
What the hell are you? I need a cupcake.
It's overly essential, right? Yeah, exactly. But it's like,
how do you say a cupcake is not essential? I beg to differ.
Exactly. But seriously, you know, so we were, you know, we were able to kind of pull through that. And now, obviously, we're on the back end of things. The strip right. is wide open. Tourists are back. Ancillary businesses that service the casino industry and the tourism industry, like Sin City Cupcakes, are back and thriving. Conventions are back, and all of our happy customers are back, and we're happy to see them. And so now, you know, we've had to take that time in 2020 and 2021, adapt. Now we're back to kind of regular mode of operation, but we're still utilizing some of those lessons and remnants of operations from 2020, for example, with DoorDash and Grubhub. Now we still have those turned on, still have the mini fridges in my Shipt stores to this day.
Wow.
Because we've got that as just a, you know, ancillary stream of revenue of third party delivery. Who knew?
And that's what I love. I mean, you know, this is a good example of, you know, getting lemons and making cupcakes. I mean, that's
lemon
exactly,
cupcakes, exactly.
Lemon cupcakes. You got lemon cupcakes brought to you by Lisa Song Sutton.
That's right. But that's right.
Here's the deal though. And Ed, it really kind of goes to, you know, work that you did in Congress and issues that I know Stacey Plasek is working on. This idea around entrepreneurs and folks, what you just heard was an entrepreneur who was backed up against a wall because of government processes and mandates. And yeah, the environment was difficult and the consequences were dreadful in that businesses shut down, but then having the wherewithal and the ingenuity to create another lane. And that's what has made this economy regardless of the period of stress we may be in. And right now we're in a period of stress. We got inflation up, we got gas prices, we have supply chain issues, yet we can't lose sight, Ed, of the entrepreneurial spirit of and ingenuity of individuals like Lisa, who are gonna take those lemons that may come from government regulations or government overreach or government heavy hand on taxation policy, trying to redesign legacy wealth so that they can't pass on the fruits of their labor and turning that around in such a way in which they create another lane of opportunity despite the difficulties in front of them. I'm always inspired by that and really excited about what the Lisa Song Suttons of the world are doing in diversifying our economy, but also in just every day creating jobs.
Yeah, Lisa, were you able to keep the prices, your prices down as a result of what's going on now in terms of inflation and all that? You know, what about prices in terms of your creativity and doing things? Did you have to increase the prices on your products?
Unfortunately, we had to across the board because our cost of goods skyrocketed. Just the bakery as an example, eggs, flour, sugar, all the kind of really just basic ingredients, all of those costs went up. You know, the big suppliers, of course, they said, hey, look, we have fuel surcharge issues. We have supply chain issues. They had a litany of reasons. And you kind of hold the line for a while because I think most entrepreneurs are pretty optimistic and we hope that costs will come back down. And so you hold the line and you say, look, I don't want to do that to my customers. I don't want to have to raise our prices. Let's wait it out. And you wait it out for 2 weeks and then a month and then 2 months and then 3 months. And finally by month four, month five, you start looking at your EBITDA, your profits are decreasing. Mm-hmm. You're not able to pay out bonuses to your staff. It literally just becomes this true trickle down effect where because the bottom line is getting squeezed, you have to figure something out. So you start, you know, cutting down costs. You start looking at where can we save on costs. And then unfortunately, that last line is actually increasing your prices to match your cost of goods.
Right.
So we're gonna leave that there. This is gonna be an ongoing conversation because businesses just don't go away. They do. They do evolve and they grow. Sometimes they run up against walls, but there's, you know, if they do have to close or shutter their doors, as Lisa has demonstrated, there's always another way to find a lane. And that's the spirit of this economy. So I just am so excited about what you're doing out there. I know it's difficult, but the message you have for, by example and an effort to a lot of small business owners out there is create your lane. You can do it. There are resources available. I would highly recommend that business owners tap into their elected leadership and let them know the impact that their policies and decisions are having on their businesses, on the businesses in those communities. And guess what? Those businesses, you know, have customers, they have workers who vote. Imagine that. So, you know, always mindful, always mindful. Ed, I'm going to give you the last word, my friend, as we wrap up this conversation on the Steel Podcast.
Well, I'm excited about what Lisa has been able to do, you know, because I just was sitting here thinking about, you know, her philosophy had to be, you know, when something is in your way, that means you own your way. And if you're not anywhere, nothing will ever be in your way. I love that philosophy, Lisa. And of course, as a result, you were able to sort of stick around and to be around even as a result of what happened with coronavirus. You know, I just think we need more business folks with the idea and philosophy that you have, because some folks, soon as something pops up in their way, they're ready to give up. So thank you for your philosophy, which I've discovered myself in the conversation that we've had. Thank you so much for what you're doing.
No, thank you. I mean, it's a gift to be able to be an American business owner and to be part of the American entrepreneurial just network, right? Like that, this is the American dream. This is what we all strive for. And you know, for as many, you know, kind of all the problems that people probably count and complain about in our country, hands down, this is the best place to build something from nothing and be able to do it, you know, in a community that loves it and supports you and is like, you know, 100% behind you. So it's a blessing.
Lisa's song, Sutton, entrepreneur, investor, risk taker. Thank you so much for being a part of the conversation with Congresswoman Stacey Plaskett from the Virgin Islands, and really do appreciate you bringing that no-nonsense business experience and acumen to our discussion today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, absolutely. And my man, Ed Towns, former congressman from the great state of New York, brother. Thank you so much, man.
Always a pleasure.
It's always good to be in space with you, and thank you for taking the time. And again, the partnership that we've been able to form around this issue is important, and I really do appreciate it. You know, to be able to stand as two African American men, one Republican, one Democrat, who are concerned about the impact of decisions on communities of color, and are willing to lend voice and ideas to helping those communities grow. I can't think of a finer brother to pair up with. So I appreciate you, man, very, very much.
Thank you.
All right, so that does it for our conversation this time, folks. Thank you as always for being a part of the Michael Steele Podcast. You know, we like to keep it real and honest and have fun at the same time. We can do that. Yep, we can be real, honest, and have fun. But I do appreciate you taking a moment to join me and my guest, the former Congressman Ed Towns, entrepreneur Lisa Song Sutton, and Congresswoman from the Virgin Island, Stacey Plaskett, in our discussion on entrepreneurism, minority business ownership, and opportunity. If you like what you hear, please, you know, do the download thing, share it with your friends. Certainly take a moment to share your thoughts on the Spreaker app, because it helps me kind of get a vibe from you where things are. And don't forget, again, I love it when you do the download thing. It makes me feel all yummy inside. And do it on Spotify, Stitcher, Spreaker, TuneIn, wherever you get your downloads. Until next time, be safe, be well, take care of yourselves. Spring is here, baby. Let's enjoy it. Masks are off. Y'all take care.
4 Psychology Hour with Dr. Andrew Jacobs is a conversation about success in sports and life, coaching, youth sports, and so much more. Listen to athletes, coaches, parents, and just ordinary folks like you who want to achieve and have fun doing it. Now you can support the show at patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. Get access to ad-free content and exclusive Patreon-only episodes. Just go to patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour. That's patreon.com/sportspsychologyhour.
Hi, this is Harry Littman, former United States attorney, current LA Times legal affairs columnist, and creator and host of the Talking Feds podcast, a roundtable that brings together prominent figures for a dynamic discussion of the most important topics of the day, from voting rights.
Voting in our country has a specific racial connotation and a racial history, and one in which it has been fundamentally about moving away from exclusion and at a snail's pace.
To the January 6th Select Committee.
We're going to see almost every actor who's culpable in this refuse the subpoena.
To U.S. national security and foreign relations.
I served in the FBI in the aftermath of 9/11, and I've seen what happens when there's boots on the ground.
To anything and everything at the Department of Justice.
The hardest thing about coming into the Department of Justice, it's not like everything hits reset. There are court proceedings and investigations that are all midstream, and you don't control when you get to make a decision on those.
To hear roundtable discussions with the country's most prominent voices from government, journalism, and law. Follow us wherever you listen to podcasts.